VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver and Andrew Smith. Faith Perlow presents this week's Everyday Grammar lesson. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Katie Weaver has this news report.
British Prime Minister Liz Truss resigned Thursday, after only 6 weeks in office. Truss was brought down by economic policy that shook financial markets and divided her Conservative Party. A party leadership election will be completed within the next week to replace Truss. She will be the shortest-serving prime minister in Britain's history. The earlier record holder, George Canning, died in office after 119 days in 1827. Truss said, "I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected." She said, "I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party." Conservative lawmakers have increasingly called on Truss to step down after she was forced to drop most of her economic policy. The program, announced on September 23rd, sent the British pound lower, creating disorder in the financial markets. "It's time for the Prime Minister to go," said lawmaker Miriam Cates. Another, Steve Double, said of Truss, "She isn't up to the job, sadly." And legislator Ruth Edwards said, "It is not responsible for the party to allow her to remain in power." Just a day earlier, Truss had promised to stay in power, saying she was a fighter and not a quitter. Truss apologized and admitted she had made mistakes during her 6 weeks in office, but she said that by changing the program, she had taken responsibility and made the right decisions in the interest of the country's economic stability. But Truss could not hold on after a senior minister quit her government, and a vote in the House of Commons turned chaotic. Truss was elected leader of the Conservatives and became prime minister following the resignation of Boris Johnson. Party lawmakers said her most likely replacement could be former finance minister Rishi Sunak, or Penny Mordaunt, who finished third in the race to become the prime minister 6 weeks ago. A national election does not have to be held until 2024. But opposition leader Keir Starmer of the Labour Party said, "Britain cannot afford the chaos of the Conservatives anymore. We need a general election now." I'm Katie Weaver.
Hafsa Ahmed is 2 years old. As she lies on a hospital bed in Yemen, it is very difficult for her to breathe or open her eyes. Hafsa is dying of starvation. She is the youngest of six children. One died from malnutrition. Her father, Ahmed, 47, works as a day laborer. Each day, he can pay for only some flour and cooking oil. Ahmed and his family live in Hais, about 120 kilometers south of the port city of Hodeidah. The town has seen some of the worst fighting in Yemen's war. Mohammed Hussein is a 49-year-old father of five. They live in a camp for displaced people near the town of Abs in the northern Hajja region. He said he has had to move four times since the war began in 2014. "I lost my home, farmland, everything," he said over the phone. 3 years ago, he lost a nine-month-old son. Now, Hussein has a one-year-old and a three-year-old who are starving. "There is no money, and I am jobless," he said. "They could die also from hunger." Dr. Nabuta Hassan directs the malnutrition area of the hospital in Hais. He said that every month it receives up to 30 children suffering from diseases related to severe malnutrition. He said that if children suffer too long from malnutrition, their organs stop working. There are more than 500,000 children in Yemen who are severely malnourished. Overall, the United Nations says around 2.2 million Yemeni children are hungry, and about 1.3 million pregnant or breastfeeding women had severe malnutrition this year. Hunger has long threatened the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemen's children. Now, the eight-year war between Iran-backed Houthi rebels and a Saudi-led coalition is threatening to return after a six-month truce. Since the war started, more than 150,000 people have been killed, and 3 million have had to leave their homes. Yemenis and international aid groups worry that if fighting starts again, hunger and starvation will get worse. And the war in Ukraine is making the situation more difficult in Yemen. Wheat is a very important part of the Yemeni diet. 40% of its grain came from Ukraine until Russia's invasion cut the supply. Peter Salisbury is a Yemen expert at the International Crisis Group. He said the war in Ukraine has hurt Yemen three times. First, Yemen lost its food supplies from Ukraine. Then the war in Ukraine brings higher food and fuel prices and takes international attention away from Yemen. Worldwide, the UN Food Agency has reduced the amount of food for millions of people because of a lack of money and higher food prices. But the World Food Program has centered its attention on the 13.5 million Yemenis most at risk. The UN said that by the end of September, its aid plan for Yemen got $2 billion of the $4.27 billion needed to provide help to 17.9 million people. I'm Andrew Smith.
Recently, my mother Ellen died. She lived a very good life. She raised three daughters. She loved art, writing, and travel. I miss my mom. So, for this week's Everyday Grammar, I want to share how we can express sympathies or condolences when someone experienced the death of their loved one. In American custom, we want to say that we care. We try to bring them comfort in their time of grief and sadness. We want to be gentle, considerate, and respectful while expressing sympathy. But how do we do this in American English? When someone dies, we usually use the phrasal verb pass away. This phrase combines the verb pass with the adverb away. We use this expression to talk about death in a more gentle and respectful way. When we want to show our sympathy or understanding for the loss of someone, we can use these simple expressions. I am sorry for your loss. I was heartbroken by this sad news. To be heartbroken means that we feel sad or hopeless, almost like our heart hurts when something bad happens. This sentence is in the passive voice, but we can change the sentence into the active voice by saying, this sad news breaks my heart. We also use these shorter expressions to describe our sadness. My heartfelt condolences, my deepest sympathies. And we can add verbs and subjects to turn the expressions into complete sentences, such as, please accept my heartfelt condolences or my deepest sympathies for your or your family's loss. Here, we turn the expression into a respectful command by using the phrase, please accept. To miss someone means that you feel sad and wish that they were still with you. We use this verb when they are still alive, but we might not be able to see them as often as we would like. But we also use this verb to say that we miss someone if they have passed away. He, she, they will be missed. This sentence is in the passive voice and the future tense. In order to show that we currently miss someone, we can use the active voice, saying, I miss her a lot. She misses her dad every day. Sometimes we share happy thoughts about someone who has passed away. For example, I will never forget when she danced in Rio de Janeiro to her favorite songs. They will never forget what he did for them. Sometimes the feeling of loss is so great that we do not always know what to say. For those times, we do have expressions that we can use, such as, I am so sorry, but I am at a loss for words. Words cannot express my sadness for your loss. Words cannot express my deepest sympathies. In today's report, we learned some ways to express our condolences and sympathies to those experiencing the loss of a loved one. We learned short expressions to share, such as, my heartfelt condolences, and my deepest sympathies. We talked about ways to express how we miss someone. We even looked at a few expressions that we can share when we feel that there are no words to describe the feeling of loss. I would like to close this report by thanking our readers and listeners over the past few weeks. Writing to us or leaving a comment has really meant a lot to me over the past month. I appreciate it so much. Thank you, and I'm Faith Perlow.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. James Madison of Virginia was elected President of the United States in 1808. He was inaugurated in Washington on March 4, 1809. The people of the city were happy with the new president, but the nation was not yet sure what kind of leader he would be. Madison's first 4 years were not easy. He had to deal with a foreign policy problem that the former president, Thomas Jefferson, was not able to solve: increasingly tense relations with Britain. Historian Alan Taylor has written several books on early American history and has won a Pulitzer Prize for his writing. He says Madison took office under difficult circumstances.
Jefferson, in many ways, was a tough act to follow because he'd been extraordinarily popular. But he had made one great policy mistake with Madison's support. Madison had been his Secretary of State. And that mistake was something known as the embargo.
The embargo had arisen from a war between Britain and France. The two nations refused to honor America's neutrality. Each tried to prevent the United States from trading with the other. Both interfered with American shipping, and the British Navy sometimes seized American sailors. President Jefferson ordered a ban on trade with Europe, but the embargo failed to end the hostile acts against the United States. A month after Madison took office, the British minister in Washington, David Erskine, said Britain would stop seizing American ships if the United States would trade again with Britain. But Erskine did not make clear that the British government demanded several conditions. One condition was that the United States continue the ban against trade with France. Another was that Britain be permitted to capture American ships that violated the law. President Madison did not accept these conditions, but he still believed he had reached an agreement with the British minister. He announced that the United States would reopen trade with Britain. Hundreds of ships left American ports. But a few weeks later, Madison received surprising news. The British government had rejected the agreement he reached with Erskine. Letters were exchanged, but Madison could not get a good explanation for what had happened. He finally broke off all communications, and Erskine and his replacement left Washington. America's policy of trade with Britain and France continued to be a serious issue. President Madison approved trade with all countries in 1810. But when relations with Britain did not improve, he stopped trade with the country again in the spring of 1811. Trade was not the only problem, however. A growing number of Americans believed that the British were helping some Native Americans to fight the United States. As the people of the United States began to move to the northern and western territories, the government made treaties with the different Indian tribes. The treaties explained which land belonged to the Indians and which land could be settled by white people. The settlers did not always honor the treaties. Historian Alan Taylor explains that Indian tribes were trying to defend their homelands. He says they asked the British to provide them with guns and ammunition to fight against the American settlements.
And the British were playing a very ambivalent game. In other words, they wanted to keep the Indians on a kind of retainer in the eventuality that war did happen. They would want to mobilize those Indians. So they did provide them with guns and ammunition, but they hoped that the native peoples would just use them on the defensive.
A leader of the Shawnee Indian tribe, Tecumseh, decided to unite all Indians and help them defend against the settlers. Throughout the West, many Americans believed that the British in Canada were responsible for Tecumseh's efforts. They demanded war with Britain to destroy the power of the tribes. In Washington, a new Congress was meeting. Some of the new members were very different from the men who had controlled Congress before. They were less willing to compromise and more willing to defend America's interests. They soon got the name War Hawks. At the same time, America had a new Secretary of State. Madison chose his close friend, James Monroe. What the United States did not have at that troubled time was a representative in Britain. The British minister in Washington, Francis James Jackson, returned to London when Madison broke off communications. The American minister in London, William Pinckney, sailed home as well. There was no official in either capital to report what was happening. And in the spring of 1812, the United States and Britain were moving closer to war. President Madison had hoped for some sign of compromise, but he was sure there would be war. He had seen the instructions from London to Britain's new minister in Washington, Augustus Foster. The foreign minister warned Foster to say nothing about any compromise. He wanted the United States to see how firmly Britain would stand against neutral trade with its enemies. Also, historian Alan Taylor says the United States did not believe Britain would stop inspecting American ships and taking away any sailors the British thought were British subjects.
And because the British would not change that policy, and the United States was determined to try to force them to change that policy, that's why the war happened.
In the United States, Congress continued to prepare the nation for war. Lawmakers voted to increase the size of the army and to borrow money to pay for things the larger army would need. But not all lawmakers wanted war with Britain. Many Federalists especially opposed it. Congressman Hermanus Bleeker showed the House a list of hundreds of names from his area of New York. He said all these people opposed the embargo and the idea of war with Britain. It is impossible, he said, that we can go to war when the embargo ends 60 days from now. Where are our armies, our navy? Have we the money to fight a war? Why, it would be treason to go to war this soon, so poorly prepared. Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin was having a difficult time finding money to borrow. He could get almost no money at all from Federalist bankers in the New England states in the Northeast. Congress had approved borrowing $11 million, but Gallatin found the banks would lend only $6 million to the federal government. The Federalists charged that Gallatin's difficulties showed that the people did not want war, especially the people of New England. If the people of the West and the South wanted to fight, then let them pay for the war. Yet, sure that Britain would not change its hostile policies, President Madison sent a secret message to Congress on June 1st, proposing that war be declared. Madison listed the reasons for war. British warships had violated the American flag at sea. The British Navy had seized and carried off persons protected by the flag. British warships also violated United States waters, interfering with American ships as they entered and left port. Another reason, he said, was Britain's orders against trade with France or allies of France. International law, he said, gave Britain no right to make such orders. Madison also spoke of the hostile Indians of the Northwest Territory and seemed to charge British Canada with helping the Indians. The president's message went to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives for discussion. The final vote in the House on declaring war was 79-4 and 49 against. In the Senate, the vote was closer, 19-4 and 13 against. President Madison signed the bill into law on June 18th. The War of 1812 had begun. The leaders in Washington did not know it, but 2 days earlier, Britain had ended its orders against neutral American trade. The orders might have been withdrawn earlier, except for a number of events. British Prime Minister Spencer Perceval, under great political pressure, had decided to end the British orders on neutral trade. Businesses and traders were loudly protesting that the orders were destroying England's economy. On May 11th, before Perceval could act, he was shot to death. Not until June 8th was agreement reached on a new prime minister, Lord Liverpool. 8 days later, his government announced that the orders were ended immediately. This was only 2 days before war was to be declared in Washington, and with ships being the only method of communication, the British action was not learned of in time. If the United States had had a minister in London during the spring of 1812, the diplomat would have been able to report progress toward ending the orders. But the American minister, William Pinckney, had returned home a year earlier.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.